Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In recent months, the mass influx of people fleeing violence in the Middle East, especially those fleeing the ongoing war in Syria, has defined Europe's refugee crisis. Most attention has been on how Europe and other Western countries should cope with the new arrivals. Most reports, though, fail to point out that Syrians who take the dangerous journey to Europe constitute only a small fraction of Syrian refugees. The largest number of Syrian refugees are those who are internally displaced in Syria, over 7 million, according to reports, since the start of the civil war in 2011. Over 4.5 million Syrians have fled to neighboring countries, including Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, and the situations there are dire. So what are the realities for the millions of Syrians who have been forced to flee their homes? Why is this happening, and what is a meaningful and dignified solution? Today we are joined by Omar Dahi, Associate Professor of Economics at Hampshire College and editor of the Syria page on Jadalia, an independent online zine. Hi, Omar. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Rami Khoury, Senior Research Fellow with the Assam Fares Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. Rami is also a Senior Fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and a syndicated columnist with the Beirut-based newspaper, The Daily Star. Hi, Rami. Thank you for joining us. And Angela Joya is Assistant Professor of Middle East Political Economy at the University of Oregon.
Again.
She is currently writing about the Egyptian Revolution and the Syrian crisis. Angela was in Turkey interviewing Syrian refugees in June and July. Angela lived as a refugee in Pakistan from 1984 to 1996. She is originally from Afghanistan. Hi, Angela. Welcome to the show. Do we have Angela? All right, well, we'll connect with them. Omar, let's start with you. So the refugee crisis is getting a lot of attention in the media, but the refugees who are internally displaced in Syria and the refugees who fled to Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey are not getting so much attention. And we're going to spend most of the hour talking about that. But what's also missing, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is some context. We're getting a lot of personal stories about refugees who are fleeing, but what about the context behind all of this?
Sure. Well, the basic context is that shortly after the Syrian uprising started in 2011, the first refugees started fleeing to Lebanon and Turkey. Pretty shortly after that, in April and May, June months, witnessed a spike in the number of people fleeing, but actually the large numbers didn't pick up until 2012, when the conflict had transformed into an all-out war between the different parties. And after that happened, we witnessed several hundred thousand refugees leaving en masse to the neighboring states, as well as widespread internal displacement throughout the country. And the context then continued throughout those years, 2013, 2014, we saw the rise of and proliferation of different armed militias. And you witnessed displacement that was sort of repeating itself. So, you know, initially people were fleeing to areas that they thought were safe. The fighting would move to those areas, or new militias would come up in those areas, and then the refugees or the internally displaced who thought they were safe would then have to flee once again. So we're seeing a rapid sort of escalation in displacement, and now not just displacement to Syria and the frontline states, but towards Europe, because of this continuation of the war that is really unrelenting and has caused over half the population to be out of their homes. So if you look at the situation prior to 2011, Syria was a country of roughly 23 million. Now we estimate that anywhere from 11 to 12 to perhaps a little bit more million people are out of their original homes.
Wow. So half of the Syrian population has been forced to flee their homes.
That's correct. Yeah. Our estimates aren't precise because We have large numbers unaccounted for, but it's a huge number, probably half or maybe even more than half.
And is it also hard to track, because we had journalists on our show on Friday who are reporting on this, and they can't get into Syria?
Yes. So there are many areas, for example, the areas that are controlled by ISIS, where people are not getting in or having extreme difficulty getting in for obvious reasons. There are areas that are active war zones. There are areas that are under siege by either the government itself or anti-government forces for a while. And so it's very difficult to report from those areas. In addition to that, there are many people who have left Syria who are in the neighboring states but are not registered as refugees. So they may be middle-class people who have found jobs in Lebanon or Turkey perhaps or Jordan, and they haven't registered themselves as refugees. Some of them, people who are going to Lebanon for a while, were going back and forth. And so it's highly likely, and in fact we know, that the number of registered refugees in the neighboring states actually underestimates the numbers who have left.
That is Omar Dahi. He is Associate Professor of Economics at Hampshire College. Angela Joya is Assistant Professor of Middle East Political Economy at the University of Oregon. And she has firsthand experience with being a refugee. She was in Pakistan from 1984 to 1996. She's originally from Afghanistan. And Angela, you were in Turkey interviewing Syrian refugees in June and July. And the question of why is this happening is a big question, but it's really important because, as I said to Omar, a lot of the stories that we're getting really lack context. So what would you add? Angela, are you with us?
Hello?
Yes, Angela, are you there? Can you hear me? We're having some technical problems with Angela's line. And Rami Khoury, are you with us? All right, we're having some technical problems. So Omar, let's dive in now and talk about the internally displaced Syrians, because that's not getting much attention. So as far as we know, there are about over 7 million people who have left their homes in Syria, but they are still in Syria.
Yes, that's correct. So the number of people has increased over time, and many of the people that are leaving have left to areas.
Omar?
Just lost Omar.
All right, we're having some major technical problems right now. I think we just lost all of our lines. All right, well, we're going to try to fix this. Today on Your Call, sorry about this, we are talking about the Syrian refugee crisis, and we are focused on the Syrians who are internally displaced, because that hasn't gotten much attention. We are also talking about Syrians who have been forced to flee to Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. About 4.5 million Syrians have fled to neighboring countries, and about 7 million are internally displaced. And we're hoping to get our guests back. In the meantime, you can go over to yourcallradio.org. There is an incredible article written by our guest Omar Dahi called Syria in Fragments, The Politics of the Refugee Crisis. And he has been he's writing about internally placed Syrians and displaced Syrians and those who have fled to Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. And Omar, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry. We're having some major technical problems here, but I think we have you on the phone now, so we should be safe with you. So let's continue talking about Syrians who have been internally displaced.
Sure. So in terms of the internal displacement, as I mentioned previously, that's the largest number of people who have been involuntarily displaced. There are estimates of 7 million, and what we see is, in fact, many Syrians, they're being displaced for several reasons. So one main reason is obviously the fighting. Many people have been displaced from areas around Damascus, like Douma and other places in the peripheries of Damascus, who have been areas that have been bombed by the government, or areas where there has been fighting between armed militias and government forces, and they seek sort of refuge elsewhere. Homs, another city in the center of Syria that has witnessed large-scale devastation as a result of bombardment, has seen entire neighborhoods and sectors of the city completely emptied out. And they're going to different places. Many internally displaced who are fearful of the regime and fearful of the government and don't want to basically have anything to do with the government anymore are fleeing to areas that are under the control of the opposition. But the problem is that once they have gotten there, over time, many of those places have been taken over by more extreme militias such as ISIS or al-Nusra, and the stay there has then itself become unpleasant, and they have had to seek refuge over again. There is a large number of Syrians, several million in fact, who are seeking refuge in government areas. So we have seen many people who are displaced from the peripheries of Damascus go to Damascus itself, into territory that is obviously now still under government control. There are large numbers of people who are seeking refuge in coastal areas. And so we've seen the areas that are now under regime control, the government control. If you see the latest maps, you see that the regime has only still controlling perhaps 25 or 30% of the territory, but that 25 or 30% still holds the largest number of Syrians, because not only of the Syrians who haven't left their homes, but those who are internally displaced from other areas into those territories. And obviously that has put further strain on the economies of those areas, because it's a very crowded situation now in those areas.
And the Syrians who are trying to find safety in areas under government control, how are they being treated? What are their conditions like?
I think their conditions vary. So many of those Syrians are Syrians who have, many of them may have very different political opinions. They may be against the government. They may be fleeing as a direct result of government bombardment to their homes. But the reports that we have is that they are welcome, they're treated well, they are there's no systematic discrimination against them in that sense. Although there are many reports that they face generally hostile treatment by security services and so on. But I think it's also the fact that they're not voicing their political opinion. So they move to those areas, many areas in the coastal regions that have strong support for the government, and there is no resumption of political life in the same way that it was before 2011, where people were really not openly deliberating and having sort of different, voicing different political opinions. So it's sort of a tacit agreement that they're welcome there, but they are also not sort of voicing objections to government policy. So it's a very fragile existence, so to speak, but in many ways it's also that many people at this point want to be done with the conflict. They political opinion has become secondary for them. What matters is survival, and even though they may have been opposed to the government, they wouldn't mind staying in government places now and later if it means safety and survival. And I think that's a statement that really is across the board based on the people that I have seen. They may have their own political opinions, but they want the crisis to be done. They want the conflict to be over.
Omar Dahi is Associate Professor of Economics at Hampshire College and editor of the Syria page on Jadalia, an independent e-zine, focusing on news in the Middle East. And let's see if we can, our other guests can hear us. Rami Khoury, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay, great. And Angela Joya, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I'm so sorry about those difficulties. It seems that we have fixed them. Great. Rami Khoury is Senior Research Fellow at the Assam Affairs Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. And Angela Joya is Assistant Professor of Middle East Political Economy at the University of Oregon. So, Angela, we got cut off when you were going to add to the context. What else would you like to add about why this is happening?
Well, I see the refugee crisis there's definitely this broader historical context, not just globally, but to the region specifically. I think about the Afghan refugee crisis that has existed, I mean, from 1980s, but it definitely became worse after 2001, where refugees who had repatriated to Afghanistan started leaving Afghanistan again. And so there has been this constant displacement of Afghan refugees that remained, I think, the top refugee in terms of numbers until the Syrian refugees kind of pushed them to number two. And so in the region, I think we often forget, we get so focused on the numbers of refugees, which is definitely a daunting, huge issue for countries to deal with. But we forget that it's these constant policies that are shaping the governments of the region through various military interventions that causes destabilization, insecurity, lack of economic opportunities for people, where people then start fleeing. I mean, now we look at refugees from the region, and it's Iraqi refugees who are leaving, Syrian refugees, Libyans, Afghanis, all the countries where there have been some sort of foreign military intervention. Or in the case of Afghanistan, I mean, I follow that closely because I have family there still. And I noticed that this state-building project under occupation has definitely been a massive failure, a failure in the sense that they tried to rebuild a state with the help of the warlords, which did not assign legitimacy to the state post-conflict, but they have also put in place a form of neoliberal chaos, in a sense that they have privatized a lot of resources, transferred it to very few politically and militarily powerful individuals, where economic opportunities for ordinary Afghans don't exist. So they're constantly fleeing, not just because of insecurity, but also because there are no jobs, no opportunities for earning their livelihood.
Mm. And Rami Khoury, what would you add to that? How do you think we should put this in context?
Well, I think the simple answer is that the modern Arab state has been quite erratic in its efficacy and its ability to respond to the rights and needs of citizens. We have six or seven Arab countries that are in the throes of terrible conflict and warfare and fragmentation, immense international and regional intervention. Now, the regional powers, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, are intervening in Arab countries as much as the foreign ones like Russia, England, and the U.S. have historically. But you have other countries that are not at war, where also you have tremendous economic and social distress, environmental pressures, virtually no political rights for ordinary citizens other than kind of make-believe parliaments and constitutions that all have loopholes where the Interior Ministry can override any constitutional guarantee simply by saying that a citizen actions threatens national harmony or something like that. So there's a fundamental, structural, chronic, and pervasive problem with statehood and with citizenship in the Arab world. We don't have a single Arab country, with the possible exception of Tunisia now, where you have a self-determinant citizenry, where the citizens have ratified statehood, the borders, the values, the policies, the mechanisms of governance. Nowhere in the Arab world other than Tunisia have people been able to say that the consent of the governed has been actually applied. And that's the fundamental problem. People put up with police states and military rule for 60, 70 years because their lives were actually getting better for most people in the Arab world, because there was a big developmental spree. That ended about 20 years ago, and it's been a real problem since then. And the real issue of migration and refugeehood is not just the flows of millions of people now because of war. It's the fact that several million people have left the Arab world over the last 40 years, and you're talking of the best and the brightest and the most dynamic young minds in the Arab world, where there's brilliant young people in banking in London and engineering in California and solar energy in India and all over the world. The best Arab minds have left the region simply because they couldn't achieve their full life potential and had no political rights and suffered all kinds of deprivation. So that's the basic underlying problem. It props up and it crops up in different forms in different countries at different times, and unless there is a resolution of the lack of citizenship and the lack of stable statehood, we're going to continue seeing these problems for years, I fear.
Yeah, Omar, I mean, the photos that we're seeing of Syrians fleeing to Europe are mostly young men.
Yes, that's correct. And I think it echoes the sort of lack of hope that many of them feel. There is, you know, the most recent spike, I think, is caused by several things, but one of it is that there are a large number of people who kept hoping, at least people who were present in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, and people who I was in touch with and spoken with and also did research with, who were still holding up faint hope of resolution or return and now have completely given up. The basic options in Syria are joining the war economy and basically being part of that sort of negative cycle of illicit and sort of illegal theft, kidnapping, smuggling, and so on, or fleeing to Europe where they can have a chance for a better future. And you're seeing large numbers of people who had law degrees, who were perhaps you can say part of the professional middle classes, desperately trying to go.
Well, today we are talking about the refugee crisis. We're talking about Syrians who are internally displaced, just over 7 million. That's not getting that much attention. And then also Syrians who are fleeing to Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, the context involved, why this is happening, what Syrians are facing, and what is a dignified solution to this crisis, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Rami, while we were reconnecting with you, Omar was talking about the realities of people who are internally displaced in Syria. What would you add to that? He said a lot of people are trying to find safety, for example, in government areas. Many people have left their villages to go to a neighboring area. What would you add to that?
Well, there's not much to add, really, and people are just trying to do whatever they can to stay alive, get enough food, have a place to live, take care of their kids, ideally keep their kids in school. I mean, people are reduced to the most fundamental basics of life. This is really about biology, not ideology. People just need to stay alive and be able to make it through till the next year and hope that a political settlement will happen somehow. They don't particularly care who's in charge. They just want to have a normal life again, because there's been four and a half, almost 5 years now of warfare, and it's devastating to not just the current living conditions of people, but what this means for the future of millions and millions of people. You know, there's 22 million young people out of school in the Arab world. It's probably now up to around 25 when you include Yemen and the latest events in Syria. There's about 25 million young people who are not in school. They're just, for various reasons, warfare, poor quality in schools, they have to work to help their family. 25 million people, when these people grow up in the next 10 or 15 years, they're not going to have a chance in hell of getting a normal job or a decent living or health insurance or anything like that. And they're going to fuel a huge new wave of criminal activity, militancy, desperate moves to just, again, survive. So the problems are so immense, and the refugee problem and the displaced, internally displaced, are sort of just the cutting edge of this much, much deeper problems of societies that are fragmenting, polarizing, militarizing, and basically failing, while there is the semblance of statehood still in place. But
and hold that thought, Rami. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the refugee crisis. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with Mark Tushman about his new book, Faces of Courage, Intimate Portraits of Women on the Edge. He writes about the abuse of women and girls. It is the most pervasive and unaddressed human rights violation on earth. For the past decade, he's traveled the world to tell their stories. We'll talk about how women around the globe are breaking the cycle of crippling poverty, sexual assault, and violence. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the refugee crisis. Syria is a country of 23 million people. An estimated 7 million have been internally displaced. Over 4.5 million Syrians have fled to neighboring countries, including Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. A recent New York Times headline says, for those who remain in Syria, daily life is a nightmare. We're talking about this today with Omar Dahi, Associate Professor of Economics at Hampshire College, Rami Curry, Senior Research Fellow at the Assam Fares Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut, and Senior Fellow with the Harvard Kennedy School, and Angela Joya, Assistant Professor of Middle East Political Economy at the University of Oregon. She was in Turkey interviewing Syrian refugees in June and July. She lived as a refugee in Pakistan from 1984 to 96. She's originally from Afghanistan. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What questions do you have about the refugee crisis? And then what questions do you have about a solution to this crisis? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Angela, you were in Turkey in June and July interviewing Syrian refugees. Where were you, and what can you just share some of the stories?
Sure. I went to Istanbul. My intention was not necessarily to interview refugees. I was planning to interview members of the Syrian opposition, specifically the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. But as I was there, I noticed how visible Syrian refugees have become in Istanbul. Istanbul and the Turkish government, they have quite an interest in allowing these Syrians to be in urban centers because they're highly educated, they speak multiple languages, and so they're quite useful as a cheap source of labor for the tourism industry in Turkey, which also caters to Gulf tourists. And so in that sense, I noticed that there's a lot more Syrian young men around Istanbul, and so I started interviewing them last year, actually, during my first visit to Turkey. And this year, when I went back, I revisited some of the same people that I interviewed last year to find out where they are, how their life circumstances have changed. And so the young men that I interviewed were mostly from Aleppo, who had just crossed closer to the border with Turkey, crossed and come over. Their stories were mostly that their families tried to find whatever means they could to send their sons out of the country. As Omar mentioned, if they stayed behind, they would be forced to join one side of the war or another side of the war. So the families tried to get them out and basically make them safer in Turkey. But I visited some of the refugee neighborhoods inside Istanbul where recently, I think over the beginning of 2015, huge number of families who have come and clustered in various parts of Istanbul. And so these families lived in dilapidated parts of Istanbul that where there are no services, and these were abandoned buildings. And so the government has put them in there temporarily with the hope of eventually taking them back to the refugee camps on the border and not allowing them there. But they were quite happy there because they felt they were freer to find a source of livelihood. And they were describing the refugee camps in Turkey, surprisingly, as really harsh conditions. They said it was like a prison. We couldn't move out. We couldn't move as we wanted to. This is better. But they were living in really indescribable conditions in these places, and complaining, of course, about the Syrian opposition and lack of support from both the Turkish government and from the Syrian opposition, feeling abandoned in these major urban centers. And so the only thing they could do, most of the women were becoming beggars, going around and begging from tourists in tourist areas. So it's a strange development with the flow over 350,000 Syrian refugees now in urban centers of Turkey, mainly in Istanbul, where they're trying to figure out and find a source of livelihood there. Mm.
And Omar, in your piece, you were in Turkey. You also interviewed people, and you write that the Turkish government has been a key player in the conflict. After having strong relationships with Syria under Bashar al-Assad, it made a radical turn shortly after the start of the March 2011 uprising. It went on to take a very advanced anti-regime position and opened up its borders for both political and armed opposition. Can you talk about that?
Well, if you go back to, you know, the early 2000s, I think one of the things that the current party that's in power in Turkey, the AKP, decided is to turn eastwards. After the drive towards the EU was stalling, it was pretty clear that Turkey is not on its way to become a full-fledged EU member. They were turning eastward, and they established this motto of zero problems with neighbors, and were essentially trying to project their power towards the Levant in many ways, both commercially and politically, and established very close ties with the Assad government. When the uprising started, they were not sure of initially what position to take, but they perceived what they saw the trend of Muslim Brotherhood coming to power in Tunisia, Egypt, perhaps Libya. And after initially expressing tepid support for the Libyan uprising, they felt that they would throw in their lot with the Muslim Brotherhood, who they had already close ties with, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. And so they fully backed that opposition camp in Syria, thinking that the government might be overthrown very quickly and would topple, as many other Western governments did. When that did not happen, Turkey in many ways doubled down and started extending more and more support to armed militant groups, increasingly many of whom were affiliated with Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups that, even though they may not have overt affiliation to Al-Qaeda, they share many of that ideology. And at the same time, of course, the intensification of the conflict was giving rise to lots of refugees going to Turkey. So they were, on the one hand, saying that Turkey and the AKP and the government is extending its welcoming to these refugees and is caring for them as proof of their concern for the Syrian people. And in many ways, the Turkish government, out of all the regional states that have received large numbers of refugees, you know, the Turkish state has the best developed state infrastructure and institutions and is the wealthiest of those states, and therefore had the best capacity and is sort of leading the response. But at the same time, it would be difficult to imagine the continuation of the conflict in Syria had Turkey not opened up its borders to those militant groups. And there were many people in the opposition who supported this, who said that this is a good thing. But the reality of the matter is that if it wasn't for Turkey's role in direct and indirect support for the different strands of the opposition, you couldn't imagine the conflict continuing in the same way as it did until today.
And so here we are today. Turkey has about 1.8 million Syrian refugees on its soil. They're trying to leave Europe. And Rami, The Guardian has had a piece yesterday reporting that the EU is divided. Leaders are appealing to Turkey for help. The proffered quid pro quo was about £1 billion in aid to improve conditions in the camps in Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. This response has had little impact so far and failed to impress the government in Turkey. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's really three levels of action that need to be taken and to address this situation in its entirety. There's the immediate humanitarian relief assistance, which is the easiest to do. The second one is the refugee law and refugee rights and asylum issues, the legal technical issues. Turkey has done better than most of the other Arab countries in giving the refugees a certain legal status that allows them to seek temporary asylum. And the Europeans now are faced with the challenge of how to handle large numbers of people who want to. 500,000, I think, went in the last year. So that issue of the legal status and the rights of refugees and asylum seekers. And the third one is the underlying, addressing the underlying causes in countries like Syria and Iraq and Libya and Egypt and other places all around the Middle East, where even where there's no war, there's lots of people who would like to leave and go and live in Europe or in the U.S. or somewhere else. And that, the much more complicated long-term issue of serious economic and political reform, which hasn't really happened anywhere to any serious extent yet. So I think there needs to be a much, much more sophisticated, decisive effort to deal with this, and I don't think any of the European countries have risen to that challenge. I think the other point I'd make quickly is, you know, the Europeans, particularly the English and the French, have a serious historical responsibility for this issue. I mean, they created a lot of these countries artificially, and then for a century or more they maintained, not a century, but say for 60-70 years, the Europeans maintained their support for autocratic Arab military-run police state-type governments. And then the British, in particular, and the Americans in 2003 invaded Iraq, wiped out the state, and created the environment for the current problems that we have with the radical jihadi groups. So you have, you know, there's three different specific reasons why some West European countries really have a moral, historical, ethical, legal responsibility, political responsibility to address this issue much more seriously than they have. Not to mention the fourth issue, which is when their own people in Western Europe sought refuge in North America and or within Europe, they were welcomed. So what we have is a terrible dereliction and hypocrisy on the part of most of the West European governments, not all of them, in addressing this issue. But there seems to be no serious effort to address that, unfortunately, because it hasn't really bothered them more than this irritation of what do you do with a couple hundred thousand people marching, trying to find a normal life. And they feel they can handle that in short-term methods.
Rami Khoury is Senior Research Fellow with the Assam Affairs Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He's a Senior Fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and a syndicated columnist with the Beirut-based newspaper The Daily Star. Omar Dahi is Associate Professor of Economics at Hampshire College and editor of the Syria page on Jadalia. Angela Joya is Assistant Professor of Middle East Political Economy at the University of Oregon. She was in Turkey interviewing Syrian refugees in June and July. Angela lived as a refugee in Pakistan from 1984 to 1996. She's originally from Afghanistan. And today we are talking about the refugee crisis. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
This is Ed. Listen to me very carefully, Rose, and your guest. Please don't call this bloody idiots ISIS. Please don't call them ISIS or ISIL. Call them Daesh. What I mean is, please promise me to do that from now on. These people, they're neither Islamic or state. Their followers are a bunch of stupid idiots, little kids who don't know anything about Islam, that forbid killing, murdering the innocent. Not only that, they're destroying our heritage. They destroy another beautiful monument. The leader of this group are a bunch of criminals hired by the U.S., others, the neocons. You know what happened? After the neocons failed badly in Iraq, created this whole mess, now the new way, use the enemy from within. They're getting most of their money from everywhere, from the West, and they're doing exactly that. They're destroying the Middle East. People, monument, land, everything, history. Don't call them Islamic. The last thing I would like to say is that the only country that has stopped them is Egypt. Egypt killed 200 of them in the last 2 weeks, in Libya and in Sinai. Sisi came, talked to Obama here, and Obama just sent him cold, saying, no, I'm not going to help you. And very proud what the Russians are doing, and they're doing exactly what they need to do, and they're going to destroy it. Promise me now, don't call them Islamic or state. They're a bunch of traitors, anti-Islamic agents for Israel, the neocons, America, and all of the West, destroying the Middle East piece by piece by piece. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling in, Eid. Rami, would you comment on that? We also have an email from Leslie who says, who is responsible for the Syrian tragedy? The answer is obvious. She writes, Dick Cheney.
Well, clearly, as I said, the American Anglo invasion of Iraq set the scene and created the environment for two things to happen that are big problems today. One, rampant sectarian violence and sectarian divisions, especially Sunni-Shia ones that were deliberately provoked in Iraq starting in 2003 by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and al-Qaeda and have now grown. And the second one is the rise of Daesh and what they now call the Islamic State, which you know most people don't accept. But these movements, Daesh, Al-Qaeda, are the fastest growing political movements around the Middle East now, unfortunately, in many ways. So yes, the Americans clearly had a role, inadvertent possibly, in setting the stage for the chaos and the militancy that that we have now. Arab countries in the Gulf, especially Saudi Arabia and others, played a big role in funding many of these groups. So there's a serious amount of responsibility and blame that can be shared by many, many people, the Arab regimes themselves, Western regimes, the Israelis, the Russians, the Iranians. There's nobody who gets off scot-free or looks good in this situation. I mean, everybody is fueling militarism and not responding politically as they need to.
Omar, what would you add to that?
I would agree with Rami. I just wanted to address a couple things that are somewhat alarming, or greatly alarming, about ISIS, is that of all the non-governmental actors in Syria, meaning all the actors outside the central Syrian government and perhaps maybe the Kurdish regions. But aside from those, one of the things that distinguishes ISIS is that I think though fueled by the destruction of the Iraqi state, not just by the invasion but by the sanctions regime, really the Iraqi society was destroyed in the 90s in many ways in what was called the cruelest sanctions regime in history, led by the U.S. So this goes back more than just the last 10 years, and I think that played a big part. The sectarian animosities in the aftermath, particularly of the invasion and also the civil war in 2006, where you saw ethnic cleansing taking place in Baghdad and elsewhere, by a lot of the government or militias affiliated by the Iraqi government. But in many ways, this has become an independent actor, and I think that's what's dangerous. And unlike those other forces, it's taking the idea of state building seriously. So if you compare ISIS to a lot of the armed militias like al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham, these are the names of different anti-government or non-government forces. They're the only ones that are attempting a holistic system of governance, you know, that includes monopolizing power and prohibiting the proliferation of arms in their territories, building religious, educational, judicial institutions, infrastructural projects. So they're taking the three characteristics of state building, you could say, monopoly on violence, economic development, and ideology very seriously, and attempting to use that to build a state. I don't think they'll succeed, of course. I think that the rule is incredibly repressive, and most people who are there are in many ways trying to get out. But many people have welcomed them because they provided a stability that was lost in the chaos of the conflict in Syria. And in many ways, it's a testimony of how bad things have become and how chaotic and destructive, that in some ways that stability, even though it's harsh and repressive, and in the long run I think the society there will reject it, but it's been a welcome alternative to the kind of chaos that was there.
Angela, what would you add to that, and what would you say about the responsibility of all of these players, from the United States to Saudi Arabia?
Well, in terms of ISIS, I think a militarized solution would not succeed at all. I mean, I see the attacks now by Russia on ISIS targets. This would not go too far, and really getting rid of the group and its appeal among young people who continually, you know, flow to the group and join the group. Last October, I was in Cairo speaking to some young men, and they were telling me about their friends who had educated young men in Cairo in an urban center, and they were saying their friends went and applied for jobs to go join the Islamic State, Daesh, and work for them. And so it has a lot to do with the circumstances, as Omar and Rami pointed out, on the ground in these countries, the lack of hope, the lack of alternatives, viable alternatives for these young men who continue to go to an organized group that shows that it's in control, that it can establish power in a region. And so there has to be something more fundamental beyond a militarized solution to bring an end to ISIS.
Well, and then talking about ISIS, there are now, what, 13 countries bombing Syria, they say, to get rid of ISIS, but according to reports, they're not being hit. What do you make of that?
Well, I have been reading about that. I actually, it started like following America's intervention there since 2013, when they started carrying out these military strikes. And when I spoke with the Syrian opposition this past June, July in Turkey, they were complaining that they really didn't come to hit ISIS targets, and they actually destroyed more infrastructure, they made more people displaced. They didn't really intend to get rid of them, they allowed them to expand. And now the same thing is happening with Russia, where their strikes are probably intentionally aiming to destroy some of the other rebel groups that the U.S. has supported, just so they could strengthen the existing government in Syria and weaken those rebels. So theirs is at least more overt in what they are doing. But absolutely, there are so many countries now involved in military strikes in Syria, all saying that they are targeting ISIS, and yet ISIS seems to be flourishing. And so it's really hard to connect the dots. What is going wrong in here? What are these countries really intending to do in Syria? The outcome, all we see is this massive flow of refugees, constant displacement and suffering experienced by ordinary Syrians.
Right. And Rami, what do you make of that? How do you connect these dots?
Well, I think it's clear that military action will not defeat Daesh or the Islamic State. And also the other thing that we've learned in the last century is that foreign military involvement inside the Arab world creates more problems and chaos than anything else. So now you've got the Russians, the Americans, the Iranians, Hezbollah, the Saudis, the French, you know, everybody and their brother is fighting in Iraq, in Syria, some of them in Iraq as well, against Daesh, and not doing a very good job, because you cannot defeat them from the air. Everybody knows that. And there hasn't yet been a serious attempt, other than the Kurds to defend their territory, there hasn't been a serious attempt to get a coordinated ground assault against the Daesh forces. But that still leaves you the problem. Daesh can be defeated, I think, militarily quite easily once all of these people work together. You still have the problem then that the underlying forces, social, economic, political, environmental, all of these underlying forces that gave rise to Daesh are still there in the region, and probably are worse now than they were 5 and 10 years ago. If you look at civil liberties and political pluralism in Egypt, for instance, it's far worse now than it was 5 and 10 years ago. If you look at freedom of expression in Jordan and the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia and other places, it's far worse now than it was years ago. So the underlying drivers of extremism, frustration, humiliation, alienation, and then desperation among ordinary Arab citizens that causes some of them to go and join groups like Daesh or others, those underlying forces are there and stronger than they were. There's also millions of Arabs being born every year that have to be fed and clothed. Egypt had 2 million babies born last year, in 1 year. And the government these Arab governments cannot possibly meet the needs of these citizens. So that's the much, much deeper problem. The militarism is just going to create a greater war. The Russians, the Americans, whoever comes in, if we knew from the Emperor Trajan 2,000 years ago coming with the Roman armies, foreign armies only create chaos, which leads to new militarism and fragmentation. And we're seeing it happen again. God help the Syrians in Syria, because foreign military aid is going to foreign military action is only going to make their problems worse.
Well, and so Omar, final thoughts from you. We've got about a minute left. If these countries continue bombing Syria, there's going to be more internally displaced Syrians, and then the funding, only 37% of UNHCR's $4.5 billion refugee budget has been funded. So what's next?
Well, I think it's clear that unless there is some sort of political settlement in Syria that attempts to address the grievances and the fears and the hopes of large sectors of the Syrian population, both from the government side as well as the opposition side, unless that happens, you can't begin to address many of those other issues. And I think there's a realization, at least internationally, that that has to happen. Of course, how and under what terms and who's going to be in charge, I think that's in large part why Russia is now taking a much more assertive role, so that they will be in a position to dictate or at least largely shape what happens afterwards. But I think the positive is that there's a recognition that a political settlement is needed. And unless you have that, you can't begin to address security and the revival of economic life, which is what is needed to stop the bleeding.
Omar Dahi is Associate Professor of Economics at Hampshire College and editor of the Syria page on Jadalia, an independent e-zine focusing on news in the Middle East. Rami Khoury is Senior Research Fellow with the Assam Affairs Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. And Angela Joya is Assistant Professor of Middle East Political Economy at the University of Oregon, and she was in Turkey interviewing Syrian refugees in June and July. Angela, Rami, and Omar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. You can head over to yourcallradio.org to read more articles about Syrians who are internally displaced and those who have fled to Lebanon, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What are the major challenges facing women and girls around the globe? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Mark Tushman about his new book, Faces of Courage, Intimate Portraits of Women on the Edge. He writes that the abuse of women and girls is the most pervasive and unaddressed human rights violation on Earth. How is education helping women and girls break the cycle of crippling poverty, sexual assault, and violence? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David Latulip is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.